Hi, I'm Scott Clapson here on KCIW. This is Perspectives in Healthcare, and I'm here today with Nanami Godfrey from Coos Health and Wellness. She is the Older Adult Behavioral Health Specialist. Hi, Nanami.
Hello.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
So I've invited you back to talk about building healthy social networks. We recently had a training on social isolation and then another successful one on elder suicide. And we had a few people come to both of them, yeah?
Yes, we did. I was really excited when I came back for the elder suicide, and everyone that came had been to the social isolation. So I guess that says something about, that I was able to do something when we talked about social isolation and at least rope them into coming back.
Absolutely. And I think the great thing about it too was seeing that it's not just you and I, recognizing a need, right? That when other people in the community found out, they wanted to come as well and participate in the dialogue. And I think that's really cool.
And I think that, I call them trainings because that's what the state calls them, but they're really presentations and discussions.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm not coming as an expert. I'm coming as a person who wants to know what it looks like for Brookings and Curry County to be experiencing these issues. We have an idea about what they are generally, and there are things that we can learn about them, but it's very specific for where we find these things taking place, how they manifest. So it's very important for people to speak back with their own experiences, whether it be social isolation, elder suicide, or any of the other discussions that I'll be bringing to the community, because that is the grassroots. That is where the rubber meets the pavement and where we really need to be sure that we are identifying needs and services to intervene.
So there's going to be more community presentations? Oh, that's so awesome. Yes, I'm acting like I don't know that that's coming, but I'm excited. We're waiting, right? We're giving a little bit of time. And for our listeners that don't know the conversations that Nanami and I have been having, but we plan to make these regular podcasts. So we'll be addressing different topics. And we thought an appropriate topic after seeing that there were people that were interested in having these discussions, right, that an appropriate topic would be for these listeners that are, you know, listening but maybe can't make it to these meetings, but they're interested in these dialogues. How do we build healthy social networks, Nanami? How do we go about doing that?
I think that social networks need to be examined for what they are. We call these, there are what's called in the lingo natural support networks. And natural support networks are the people that are around us. Now, it could be our family, but for a lot of us who are in alternative kind of relationships and who've kind of built relationships with other people outside of our biological families that are more important to us, it has to do with being the natural supports, the people we select. Hear that choice bit? Okay. Choice is what it's all about. So who do we turn to in times of trouble? Those are the people that are our natural supports. And those are the support networks that are very important to us in times of stress. The differences between the age groups is very important for us to consider, because when we're young and when we have our families as young adults, there are people that are naturally around us who are there to support us, most of us anyway. There are situations where people are disenfranchised and whatever and lack that support network. This has to do with how important support networks for all of us. So most of us are very lucky in the sense that we have people around us who are there to support us in times of stress and need. As we age, though, remember I used this, I know, in another podcast, I said the way we treat our elders is something we have to pay attention to, because they're the only minority that we are all going to become a part of. So when we treat elders with disrespect, when we disregard the cultural impacts of aging in our society, we are eventually going to face them ourselves. So how we look at them and what we do to intervene will ultimately impact us personally. So when we talk about social networks, when we age, there are natural things that happen within this culture. I'm not saying all cultures. It's naturally within this culture. We retire. We go through empty nest. You know, our kids leave us. We have relatives who end up passing away. And what ends up happening is that natural support network that a lot of us can take for granted is slowly eroding. So we lose those connections with people that we need in times of stress. And that makes us vulnerable.
So how does one, right? It sounds kind of like we're kind of choosing, but we're not choosing because it's cultural, right? And so how does one go about sort of undoing these cultural agreements that we have that isolate us as we age?
I think that it has to be mindful. I mean, the lingo in a lot of therapeutic interventions has to do with mindfulness. Unfortunately, in our culture, we don't want to age. So when we go and we see movies, we don't see older folks aging in positive, healthy ways. We don't see positive depictions of aging. So when we don't see positive depictions of aging, or when we hear aging always affiliated with loss or chronic disease, all the negative things that an American would attribute to aging in our culture, what we tend to do in this culture is we try to push those things away from us. We don't want to be aware of it. And in doing that, we lose our connection, our understanding, and our mindfulness about how that will impact us. So all of a sudden, we wake up and we're 65 years old, and maybe we've just lost our spouse, and our children have left the nest, and we don't have that support network. So now we're in stress because we've lost our most significant relationship in our life, and the other part of our natural supports are no longer there. So the fact that we've chosen and we actively choose, and this is the part that we need to be mindful about. Because the fact that we kind of dissociate from the fact that we're aging and how culture plays in with that aging process, we're not mindful and we're not active in continuing to recruit and be a part of building social supports. So what's ended up in our culture, a lot of what we in the, you know, who are actually working with older adults see is this: the natural support networks get replaced with professionals, with care providers. And if you're lucky, one of the most positive things that can happen for older adults is a connection with a senior center like the CHECO Activity Center. Those positive supports are the ones that we need to be bringing on board. The care providers, the professionals tend to carry a lot of that kind of patriarchal kind of attitude of aging. They want to tell us what our experience is. When you are in a meaningful social interaction with a place or a person, that means you're having, and this is right from the training, I'm going to say, or the discussion, meaningful social interaction means that we are having conversations of relevance to the people that are in attendance, and that we choose to be there, not that we're forced to be there, not because we have to be there, but we actually want to be part of the dialogue. But that means also on the other end, they have to be listening to elders too. That has been a missing part of this as well.
And how has it been missing? Like, who's not listening to the elders, I guess, is a better way of asking that.
Because our culture does not want to face its own aging process, and it pushes away the idea that we're aging. So the women color their hair, you've got the facelifts, you've got the trying to get the wrinkles put away, you've got all these things which talk about an attitude of not wanting to age.
And that's not just women.
No,
men,
it's not.
Men do it too.
Yes. But the point is that it's embraced by a culture, okay? And so therefore, when elders have something to say, it's like if you go in, let's say you walk into a dining room and there's a very elderly person, and maybe they're a little frail. That does not mean that they do not have the ability to make their own decisions and not have active, very in-depth philosophical conversations.
Mm-hmm.
But how often, and I guess I'm asking the listeners to also think about this, how often do you hear those conversations take the tone of an adult to a child? How often do you hear decisions being made outside of the person, the older person who is sitting in attendance? That is something that we all witness. And unfortunately, it's something that our children are witnessing too. So they're literally being socialized into this attitude of aging themselves. Remember, we are all growing into this minority. So as we socialize our children, we are also setting up the dynamic that they will face this as they age as well. So it's something we need to be mindful about.
Yeah, it's very interesting to observe that, to witness that, as you said, that decisions sort of being made for the person without talking to them, not including them in it, or I hear it, you know, certainly sometimes at the Chetco Activity Center where there's someone who, you know, maybe someone thinks is incapable or whatever, and all of a sudden it's like a parent talking to a child rather than an adult talking to another adult. And so I even witness it, you know, in my work at the Chetco Activity Center sometimes with people. It's fascinating.
But right? And understand that this is bigger than individuals. So this is not about blaming. It's about...
Oh, no, not at all.
Right, right. But what I'm saying is a lot of times we get into this dynamic when we're talking about issues that are difficult to talk about. We get into either when we say things that are factual, like what we both have shared as far as watching those dialogues happen with older folks, that we get into once somebody says that, there's automatically a defensive posture from other people. And I want to do is tell the audience is that we are all brought up in this culture and we're all affected by our socialization. The way it plays out in us that we have to be mindful about in order to choose the way we want to act. But that doesn't mean we have to be defensive about it. It means that we need to acknowledge that we have all been part of that. And to make the active choice to do something differently so that we can start shaping the reality for our elders and ultimately ourselves as we age, and then again, our children as they age. So we can, we are advocates not only for the elders of this generation, but the elders of all generations to come. And that is, it absolutely hangs on the responsibility of all of us to be able to be mindful and to make an active choice.
And I also think it bears mentioning that sometimes that happens too, right? You're talking about younger people. Sometimes it happens where younger people are sort of talked down to as well,
yes.
You know, and instead of being talked to like they're people, they're talked to like, oh, well, you're a child, so I'm going to talk to you like a child. And it's fascinating because people don't give a very good response when you sort of put them in a category like that instead of talking to them like an individual. How do we be mindful then in our communication when we're approaching each other, regardless of what our age is?
I think it starts with actually caring to listen to each other. And I think that a lot of times, and I've heard this said over and over again, and it's so true in social interaction, a lot of times we listen to respond. And that's not how we are supposed to listen. We are supposed to listen because we care, because we're interested in knowing more about a person. If we listen to respond, it is about us. It is about our position and how we look. If we listen because we care, we actually get deeper into that person because our responses reflect that interest.
We listen because we care, not listen to respond. I like that. I agree. I try to be mindful in my own life to be present, right, when someone's talking rather than thinking about, you know, what I'm going to say next when I became aware of that kind of phenomenon. I was like, oh, I do that too. And so how do I, you know, as Scott, go about my life and actually hearing what the other person's saying rather than being like, okay, they're talking, now let me formulate what I'm going to repeat back. So far what I hear you saying is being mindful mm-hmm. and listening are two really strong ways that we can build social, healthy social networks, correct?
Right. I think that what ends up happening is when we listen genuinely, when we listen because we care, what we end up happening is it opens people. People who feel listened to feel understood. And when they feel understood, they actually share more. So we can get to know other people's needs better when we actually care to hear what those needs are. A lot of the reason our systems are broken is because they're listening to come up with a treatment. So again, it's listening to respond. It may be some kind of pharmaceutical intervention. It could be some kind of treatment. But the fact is, you are not listening because you care as a professional. You are listening to respond. You are listening to correct. You are listening to fix. Huge difference.
Kind of sounds like motivational interviewing. Have you heard
yeah.
of that?
Thank.
Some of our listeners may not know what motivational interviewing is. Would you like to unpack that for our listeners so they understand what that term means?
Motivational interviewing, and I'm going to do it based on how I apply it. So there's
sure.
a lot of different techniques that motivational interviewing uses. But it is about understanding what makes people, how people respond and how they can behave in more positive ways. If we are motivating someone, we need to get to the core issues that make them not only look at themselves, but be to kind of buy into the process and want to be part of it. So a lot of the techniques in motivational interviewing, which is actually part of therapy, it's therapeutic intervention, has to do with centering on the person that you are providing services to. So it's not about me as the therapist. It's about the person that I am working with and making them the center of it, helping them, reflecting things back to them that keep them moving forward. So that's kind of a Reader's Digest version, I think.
I think that's a very good Reader's Digest version. It's very easy to go into a therapist's office or a provider's office and be sort of told the textbook. Well, I'm going to use smoking as an example because that's one of the things that we've had, you know, with us, with our stuff with All Care and the things that we've done and how we learned about motivational interviewing for our advisory council. And it was this idea that, you know, you go into the provider's office and the provider says, well, you know that smoking's bad. Don't you want to quit? You don't want to have a heart attack, do you? Well, that doesn't change anybody's behavior. The smoker may already realize that smoking's bad for their health, but the doctor or the healthcare provider reinforcing that, like you talked about earlier in the podcast, just sort of sets the person off on the defensive at that point. Because it's no longer about the person who's smoking. It's all of a sudden about the healthcare ramifications of smoking.
And it's also about the intervention.
Yeah.
Do this intervention. This works in this position.
Yeah.
That's the problem. I remember doing an interview myself, and I was asked the tenets of motivational interviewing. And I literally told them, because to this day, I mean, there's certain things like developing discrepancy, which is exactly what you were talking about. So developing discrepancy is one of the tenets of motivational interviewing. And what that means is when you have adverse healthcare effects because you're smoking, the reflection becomes, meaning what I talk back to a person who's smoking about is I talk to them how what their behavior is doing is sabotaging their health. okay? The problem is when you take the tenets, meaning the foundational techniques, and you apply them without an understanding of a person, what you end up doing is showing that you are literally listening to respond. So I'm going to put a tenet in your face because you just told me, you know, I have emphysema because I've been smoking, or my asthma's kicking up because I'm smoking. And what I just put back in your face is that you need to stop smoking because you know it's doing you harm, which is absolutely the wrong approach. It's not about what's motivating that person. It becomes a shame dynamic that makes that defense go up. So you've literally created a wall between the person and yourself, which is, and this is, I hope, help me with this, but I am going to try to link this to what we do with elders. Mm-hmm. In rural areas, there are a lot of elders who do not want services.
Mm-hmm.
I'm fine. Leave me alone. There is a reason for that. So if I'm going to use motivational interviewing correctly, what I'm going to do is I'm going to look past the fact that they're saying, you know, get the heck away from me. I don't want anything to do with you. I'm going to look past that and try to figure out why they have the attitude that they have. There's always a why.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is when we stop asking why. Okay, well, they have been blackballed by all the systems. They are not allowed at the doctor's office. They get talked to lousy from the people who are around them. That is why they want to be left alone. Now, if I address the reasons why they have the attitude that they have, now that defensive posture can start to be lowered. But I've got to acknowledge what motivates them first. Not me.
Mm-hmm.
Not what motivate me just because, you know, I have my asthma because I smoked a cigarette. I picked up the cigarette, though, because my boyfriend just broke up with me and he was abusive the whole time we were together. Okay. And I just got off the phone with him. Now, hear the difference? If I'm the practitioner and I'm only acknowledging that you picked up the cigarette, what are you, stupid? You got asthma. Okay. The whole part of my boyfriend just calling me up when there's a restraining order and harassing me. So what am I using the cigarette for? I'm anxious. I'm not feeling safe. Those are what's underlying the picking up of the cigarette.
Mm-hmm.
Now, once I know the motivation to the negative behavior, now I can start unraveling and creating positive behaviors to cope with the boyfriend that's calling and harassing.
Wow, you just helped me unpack motivational interviewing. That was for a podcast way down the road. But I appreciate that, Nanami. Thank you. There's all these wonderful terms for our listeners that are used in the healthcare industry, and motivational interviewing is one of them. And it's something that I've learned a lot about, and I really appreciate you. Because we've talked about trauma-informed care and some of these other things in our other podcasts that we've done here on KCIW, but motivational interviewing hasn't really been unpacked like that yet, so I appreciate that wonderful explanation. I'm Scott Clapson here on KCIW. This program is Perspectives in Healthcare. I am here today with Nanami Godfrey from Coos Health and Wellness, and we are talking about building healthy social networks. KCIW is a nonprofit, and we do appreciate your donations. So, Nanami, so we have mindfulness, we have listening, and not from our own perspective, but with the perspective of listening to hear what the other person is going through. We have kind of understanding what motivates people, which I think is also helpful in building healthy social networks, because motivation is a big part of it. You know, you have to be motivated to want to engage with people. One of the things that you and I didn't realize was going to happen was that we talked about this before this podcast, that we accessed some people with these last couple podcasts that we did that were feeling socially isolated.
Yes.
In our area. For those people that, you know, maybe like you mentioned a couple minutes ago, are, you know, they can't get in to see a therapist because they've been put on a do not see the therapist list because they're difficult. Any number of things. If someone's in that space where they're hurting so much, there's so many walls up, how do we go about deconstructing the walls? Because it sounds like that person has to be the one who takes the step, right?
Yes.
To start deconstructing those walls. How do we go about doing that?
A lot of times when people act out who've been hurt, the problem with providers is we're all individuals, you know? A lot of people who do, whether it be therapy or any kind of health care, they tend, when people are acting problematically, and they want a lot of people who act in ways that get them blackballed and not allowed into services, they have a lot of accusations. They have a lot of projections. Projection is, I feel this way about myself, but it hurts so much, I can't hold it anymore. So when somebody's approachable and when somebody's approachable, a lot of times that projection gets put out onto you. What that means in actuality is it could be a test. Are you safe enough for me to unload this on you? Or number two, I can't hold it, and so I've got to take this poison out of myself, and I'm putting it on you. The problem with the provider always comes when they respond, because a lot of providers react. They react like the insults from people who've been disenfranchised and hurt their entire lives is about them. You need to understand this is not about you. And the more that you take it on, the more you are getting in the way of anything therapeutic happening. So that doesn't mean you sit and you take it. And this is really important for anybody who's dealing with behaviors that are problematic. You don't sit and take a behavior when it's abusive, and it can become abusive. You can understand that this is coming from the person, and it is an indication of how hurt they are inside. And what you can say is, when you calm down or when you want to talk again, please call me. But I cannot continue this conversation as it is right now. I hope you are well. I will talk to you later. Goodbye. And you hang up the phone, okay? Because you cannot take someone else's, you can't accept that as part of yourself. And that is where it gets problematic with providers. A lot of providers will go and actually start to fight with the person. It's not therapeutic to fight with someone. This is when someone is reacting and they're projecting their own pain on you, they are in a reactionary mode. They have been triggered by something, which is an autonomic brain function. It is literally, it's like the equivalent of vomiting and trying to stop it. It is an autonomic reflex that comes from years and years of trauma, where that reaction comes up and it's hurled at you. You need to understand that it is automatic, and it is a trigger from trauma and abuse. So that once you understand that and you can distance yourself, when you interact with them in response, tell them how they can respond to you, how they can interact with you in a way that you can be there for them. So setting boundaries, saying, you know, I'll talk to you when you calm down, give me a call. You know, I'm really sorry you're having a hard time, but we can't talk like this. And hang up. So it's really important. And provided, and we also need to be very clear about this. When you're talking to somebody who's highly agitated and they're projecting on you and they're highly angry, it is different than when somebody is when they're talking about trying to harm themselves, okay? If somebody's talking about trying, let's say they're agitated and they're escalating and they talk about wanting to do themselves harm, okay? The most important thing, and this is where social isolation comes in with suicide, okay? And that's why the two discussions were intimately linked, is when somebody is talking about doing harm to themselves, social support is absolutely essential because you do not want to leave that person alone. For these people who are disenfranchised by the community, these people don't have a lot of social support. A lot of times, who's going to end up in their doorway in times if they're planning on committing suicide is going to be law enforcement. And unfortunately, that is not the most therapeutic way to be dealing with someone who is suicidal, to have law enforcement show up, because law enforcement, while it is getting more educated on how to deal with those situations, a lot of these older folks have much history of being responded to in ways that got them put in handcuffs, thrown down on the ground, mistreatment, which furthers the trauma inside them. So you're trying to do something therapeutic and intervene in the process of caring for someone, and what you end up doing is further re-traumatizing them. So these are all things that come together and complicate our ability to provide people with what they need. So the active choice of individuals must take place. For all these people who are disenfranchised within this community, who feel that there is no one there for them, the most important thing is to reach out and to understand the consequences of the choices that you make, so that if you choose to reach out, that is a positive thing. If you have made it so that no one will respond to you, understand that when you are in danger, it's not necessarily going to be the most therapeutic person to be there for you in your most time of need. So creating those social relationships and building on them is absolutely essential. And it needs to become a part of our normal aging process for all of us, so that none of us have to be disenfranchised.
So if someone's feeling this, right, and they're feeling this, whether they've been locked up in handcuffs before because they've had a welfare check, or they've been shut out by people because of their behavior, right? I mean, there's a few people I can think of in this community that I've been, you know, told about, oh, you know, don't bother with so-and-so because they're crazy, or they're difficult, or they're a problem, or whatever words are used to describe them. If someone like that's listening and doesn't really understand what they can do to build a positive relationship, what could they do? Who could they reach out to? I mean, obviously calling the Chetco Activity Center is a great way to go about that, but that might be kind of overwhelming, right?
It's very overwhelming. And I think that group sessions, you know, doing anything in groups for someone who has been disenfranchised and been off and feeling very isolated is a huge step. Reaching out to an individual, someone you feel safe to, is absolutely essential. So there may be a connection that you have with someone that you feel safe with. And I'm going to put the caveat on that is, while you're dealing with all your issues, while you have normal projections that are going to happen as part of your triggers, which is understandable with a lot of the horrific things that people endure in this day and age, understand that other people outside of you need to be safe from those things. It is not about them. It is about you. And it is about taking responsibility for the fact that it is about you. The more that you put it off on someone else, your anguish, your pain, whatever, if you are constantly putting it to someone else, that means that you have no power in the situation. You have literally put yourself in a perpetual victim mode. And what that does is it keeps you in a place of victimhood. So you have to actively choose to be responsible. And I remember this as a PTSD survivor myself. I remember how angry I was that the psychiatrist I was going to was constantly telling me that I had to take responsibility. And I was very angry, and I told her, I said, these people did this to me. Okay? The good news was I was angry and it was positive, but it's very important to know when you're reaching out to someone, if you end up pummeling them, they will not be there for you. So understanding that there needs to be, you know, having a way to deal with that anger in a way that's positive, that doesn't break the connections that you're forming, has to be. Even when you're talking to someone and you project, being able to take responsibility and say, you know, that was a bad day for me. It's understandable that these things happen. But maybe the first part becomes, that was a bad day. And a reflection from someone who cares was, you know, you get, let's say I get a call from somebody who called me and who went off on me, because that's happened. And they call me and I say, wow, you had a bad day, didn't you? Because what that does, it's allowing them to have their bad day and not making them bad in the process. Understanding that it is part of a process. It's the process of healing.
Well, it's also the process of being human too, right? I mean, I think there's any sort of number of reasons why people can have bad days and lash out or project. And sometimes maybe doesn't even have anything to do with trauma. Just that, you know, sometimes we just have bad days. I have them, you know, where it just, nothing seems to go right. And everything, and then everything everybody says, I'm taking it personal when it has really nothing to do with me, right? It's just their own stuff. But it goes back to that idea of mindfulness.
And it also, what you just did in just that little sentence was just beautiful, and you need to get your therapy license. Okay. So what you just did was called normalizing. You took something that everybody has pathologized in these disenfranchised people, and you took it into a behavior and something that we all can recognize. And that is called normalizing, and it is an extremely effective tool that is underutilized by most providers. Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome. Yes, Nanami and I have actually, one of my personal goals is to become a therapist, and I've had that goal since childhood, and I've just been holding off till my 40s, and now I'm in my 40s, so we're on our way. Thank you, Nanami. We talked also about the importance of laughter when we're doing these really heavy subjects, right? Because we, you know, you and I have both met some people that in this process that are really struggling, that are really, they are really isolated. I mean, I feel isolated sometimes, but it's very different from some of these people that I'm encountering now that are, they're still kind of in the periphery, right? They don't really want to be acknowledged. They don't really want to come out to group activities or things like that, but they're really isolated and they're really alone, and they feel really alone for many different reasons. And my heart goes out to them, because when you're in that kind of a situation, how do you undo all of this? You know, it's a lot, and it's a lot to take it one step at a time.
Right.
And remember that, you know, it's a process. It's going to take some time, because trauma is very impactful to people's lives, and it can
Absolutely.
Really shape who they are.
And unfortunately, you know, I think that one of the things that we fail to recognize about our culture is that trauma is a part of everyday life. We do not deal with people well in this culture. We ostracize, we marginalize, we make it us and them. We are all about division and conquer. We're all about hoarding things for some and not having anything for others. This is something that has to stop if we are going to have a mentally healthy society. For our elders, it puts them in a more vulnerable spot. All of these things that I talk about, because of the culture of what aging is in our society, it makes elder folks more vulnerable to all of these things. And the fact that they do not have the natural supports, the fact that they can't just turn to someone and just have a normal process of a conversation, makes a lot of these small problems become bigger problems. And unfortunately, a lot of what's happened for some providers is they end up prescribing pharmaceuticals rather than, it's almost like, if I give you a pill, will you go away? And we deal with that. And I'm not saying all providers. There are good healthcare providers everywhere. But the problem is sometimes it especially for someone who doesn't have transportation,
mm-hmm.
who doesn't have access, who lives in a rural community, it is like finding a needle in a haystack. And when you don't have the means and you don't have the money and all of those other factors come on top of it, you don't have your basic needs. Making that connection is even more difficult.
And also, when someone is given pharmaceuticals, right? And I think we've talked about this maybe before, and I don't know if it's been on a podcast, but when those pharmaceuticals are not there and the person doesn't have the coping skills, right? Because that's really what therapy is about, right? I've spent a lot of time, thankfully, because of a welfare check about 10 years ago, in therapy because of that. And I've been in therapy off and on ever since. And that's one of the things that I've learned to process is these coping skills rather than just saying, oh, well, let me go, you know, take a pill to get over X, Y, and Z. How do I develop those coping skills? So if I do need a pharmaceutical, it's there, but it doesn't become something that I'm relying on to help me get through. Does that make sense?
Yes. And I think that in some ways, I think that we have to be realistic about the hypocrisy of relying on pharmaceuticals. Because while addiction is still criminalized in many regards, addiction is criminalized. Prescriptions are written, you know, all over the place. You know, opiate addiction. I can't tell you how many people I've come across who have become heroin dependent, but they started out with a prescription for pain medication mm-hmm. and overused it and ended up being dependent on opiates. And instead of tapering them down because it's too much of a trouble, it is completely withdrawn. And so this person is starting to go through withdrawal and they have nothing. So what do? They hit the street. Mm-hmm. And then they end up with law enforcement being involved. So all of these things complicated. We need, again, I'm going to bring in that term, we have to be mindful in how these things fit together. It's a whole picture. We can look at every little single part, but we're not going to see how it complicates the whole scenario for people because we're not mindful about how it comes together. And that's why these conversations, people coming together in a community to talk about issues is so important because it is where the rubber hits the pavement. It is where it is actually being experienced in the trenches. And those qualitative stories, not the numbers that a lot of the state, you know, state wants to see. Numbers don't say how it qualitatively impacts the life of people. So in the community assessment that I've been disseminating through Curry County, because Curry's going gangbusters with it, Coos is having a slower time of it. The last page on my community assessment is page 4, and it's basically blank. And I call that the rant page. And it is. It's a rant page. The things that are really driving people crazy, that make their lives difficult. And that really needs to be talked about because it is about quality of life. It is about it. And I'm going to tell you this, as much as the state says that it likes, you know, the numbers, the quantifiable facts about like how many people are on food stamps, how many people have to access, a food bank, you know, in a month. It also, the legislators are really, really interested in hearing the stories from people about what it is to live. What is it to age in Oregon? What is it like to age in Brookings or in Pistol River or in any of Carpenterville? This is all very different, and it has to be told if we're going to be able to let the state know that we are here, we deserve to be considered, and if we're going to do things well, it would be real nice if they would send some money our way in a way that's going to make a difference. But if they're so busy making programs and shoving people in them, and they're started in places like Salem or Portland, guess what? It doesn't fit.
Well, that's why I'm a grassroots organizer. Because you start from the bottom up, right? One of the things that I've noticed since being back in these last 3 years in Brookings is, and maybe why you experience such a willingness and enthusiasm here on the Southern Oregon coast, in Curry County and in particular in Brookings, is because we're used to being forgotten about, right? We're used to Portland and Salem and Eugene forgetting that we're here. I mean, they know that we're here because they want to come here and go to the beach, but then at the same time, they forget that people actually live here, right? From day to day. And that becomes a real thing where we have to kind of do it on our own sometimes, you know, and hope that through these podcasts or different things that we do, we can show them that, hey, we can come together as a community and we can make this happen. And then hopefully the state realizes it and puts some money behind it. But in Brookings, we try not to always reach out to the state. I mean, I think the sinkhole kind of, it paints it in a different light. But then again, that's not really a sinkhole either. That's an actual waterway that was paved over. So, you know, the same kind of thing of just kind of realizing where our resources come from. And we've got a lot of really great resources right here in Brookings Harbor. And we can wait for the state to notice us and want to do something, or we can continue to keep on engaging and keep on keeping on and be grassroots about it.
And one of the things that I'm hoping that my position does as the older adult behavioral health specialist, it puts me in a place. I know that. I mean, my love is in rural communities. I also share your opinion that when changes come, because rural communities are left on their own and they have to survive on their own, there's such creativity that goes on within rural communities. My ability, me in this role, being funded by the state initiative, which is the Older Adult Behavioral Health Initiative, allows me to take the data from my community assessment, from responses to the discussions that I have. All of that goes back to the state. So the more information that we have, the more that we're speaking back. And the more numbers and the more qualitative data, namely the stories that are being told about what it is to be last on the totem pole when the money is being divvied out, it allows something to go back that has teeth. But I need to have those participants and people willing to, and none of the stuff that's going back has anybody's name on it. It's about numbers and it's about stories. And it's about letting them know that we are here. And some of the things we're doing are really cool. And when we do that, and when we're effective at doing things, that needs to be paraded for the rest of the state to see. There's no shame in being able to have pride in what your community does, in pride in being resourceful and making things out of nothing. I think that needs to be held up as a model, and being able to talk about how much money that saves the state, and where we actually could use some funding to support so that we can be effective and possibly become a model for other places who are struggling with the same.
Yeah. Well, I think our Walk with Ease program is a really great example. I was at a meeting for the Area Institute on Aging a while ago, and they were talking about Walk with Ease and not getting a lot of response in rural Southern Oregon for Walk with Ease. And I looked across the table at Glenn DeGroff, our co-leader for Walk With Ease here in Brookings, and she's like, are you going to raise your hand or am I? And I'm like, hold on. We have a very successful program here in Brookings that we're now into we're going to start our 9th group at the end of February. And we've had over 50 people in a year and a half participate. And I've gotten 5 phone calls already this week based off of a podcast that we just aired on KCIW and the New Flyer. And I'm just so thrilled. And it just goes to show, right? Because sometimes people write us off and think, oh, well, you know, it's so far away and it's, you know, people in Brookings and wherever. But people here really, they do want to engage and they're really interested in bettering themselves and bettering their community.
So those are numbers that need to go back. And those are numbers that need to be, I mean, certainly I might be able to incorporate with the Older Adult Behavioral Health Initiative in the sense that if there is something that to better the lives of seniors in your community and it is organically driven from within, then it is something that needs to be broadcast as a positive thing about Brookings and should be part of the information going back to the state as part of the Older Adult Behavioral Health Initiative. So I'd welcome a connection, you know, with them so that I can start monitoring that and start talking about ways. Maybe that is something we can replicate in Coos County. A lot of the direction that I'm actually seeing because of different obstacles that we're facing in Coos County, I am looking to Curry County as a model and trying to find avenues about ways to get things started. And I would really like that it become kind of a symbiotic relationship between the two counties where we can share ideas and better the lives of our elders in our community by seeing what is working. So, I mean, I would welcome that.
Look at us building networks all up and down
the coast. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my goodness. Huh. I really appreciate you, Nanami. I really thank you. And I learn so much when we sit down together to talk. I really appreciate it a lot. And we've talked a lot today about building healthy social networks and how do we mindfully, there's that word again, mindfully do that. As we come to the end of the podcast, is there anything else that you would like to share about mindfulness or building healthy social networks?
I think that I'll just put a plug in for the next thing that I hope that I'll be able to share with the Brookings community and the Southern Coast community, and that is trying to do some networking with caregivers in the area. By and large, for rural areas that do not have resources, it falls upon family members and that support network we were talking about to care for people who are aging, possibly suffering from chronic illnesses. So I have actually created a presentation called Caregiving Essentials, which is pretty much about caregiving for the caregiver. Really kind of trying to empower people to understand how important they are when they take on that role, but also how to take care of themselves. I think that I'm already getting some responses. I've had a request from the Gold Beach area to do a something on Alzheimer's. I think they have a group up there that is interested in doing some Alzheimer's support. I came across an amazing training online because I'm constantly doing research. And there is, and I can't remember what university had done it, but they actually, this was wonderful. We're looking into non-pharmaceutical ways to deal with problematic behaviors for folks with dementia and Alzheimer's. And what they ended up finding, which it goes right to Therapy 101, is, like we talked about before, when you see someone who doesn't know when to drink, when to eat, that kind of stuff, and they are acting out behaviorally, remember what I said earlier, you don't look at the behavior, you try to look at the motivation behind the behavior. They haven't drank all day. They didn't get any sleep last night. So once we start to acknowledge and we are paying attention to folks with dementia and Alzheimer's, and we actually see what they're needing, the behaviors go down because we're intervening where they need intervention. It's not rocket science, but it was so nice to come across some scholarly material about a study that pretty much said the same thing.
Awesome. I'm really looking forward to your Caregiving Essentials presentation. We are currently, as this week we record this podcast, Nanami and I are working out the details of bringing that presentation here to the Chetco Activity Center in Brookings. So stay tuned for a podcast about caregiving essentials and a new flyer. Thank you, Nanami, for being here today. I really appreciate you again. She's blushing for our listeners that can't see.
Thank you.
You're really great, though. And it is really great that the state has people in your role, right? Because there's more than just you. There's like 13.
No, there's 26.
26 older adult behavioral health specialists around the state. And it's really important work, right? I've learned so much from you as someone who works here at the Chetco Activity Center doing programs coordination. You've been such a help to me, and I can't even imagine the help that you've probably been to all the other people like me that you work with up and down the coast in Coos and Curry County. So it's really valuable stuff, very, very much mindfulness related. I'm Scott Clapson here on KCIW. This has been Perspectives in Healthcare, and we have been talking with Nanami Godfrey today from Coos Health and Wellness. She is the Older Adult Behavioral Health Specialist. I say that so well now. It's such
yes,
a mouthful. We've been talking about mindfully building healthy social networks. Thank you so much, Nanami, for being here. If you enjoy this programming, please donate to KCIW. Thank you, and have a great day.
Thank you for listening to Curry Coast Community Radio, your community-supported radio station. If you like this program and want to hear more like it, consider supporting Curry Coast Community Radio by volunteering your time or contributing to our capital campaign to help us get on the air. For more information, go to our website, kciw.org.